writer's voice. To celebrate our 30 years of on-air service, Virginia Voice's Patty Campbell talks to noted writers about their lives and work.
Our guest tonight is noted author David L. Robbins. David, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
It is always a pleasure and an honor to be asked by the Virginia Voice to do anything for you folks.
Well, thank you. You're a Richmond boy, aren't you?
Born in the East End, wrong side of the tracks, that's me.
Did you train to be a writer, or did you train to do some other work and write at night?
I was raised by good people in a good part of town. Sandston, Highland Springs, shout out, yo. I was raised in a really good end of town, but it was a humble part of town. And it, I think to this day, keeps a lot of the characteristics that I loved about it when I was growing up in Sandston in the late 50s, early 60s. But I was not one of those self-identifying kids where some teacher came up and said, oh, he's a good storyteller. They said, oh, he needs to shut up. And so I didn't come through the educational system thinking about being a writer. My mother was a born storyteller, and so I inherited that from her. But, you know, who comes to you and says, hey, you can make a living as a writer when you grow up in Sandston and Highland Springs? And also, my parents were the children of immigrants. They weren't the sort of people who really said, hey, you know, our son has got this gift. We should encourage that. They're like, no, be a lawyer, be a doctor.
So what did you do?
I went to law school.
And did you ever practice law?
I did. I have notably called law school the great catch basin for the unfocused overachiever, meaning I and so many other people who end up in law school, I knew I was smart, and I knew I was articulate, and I knew I wanted to help. You know, it had the taint of a mission, law school, service. And then I found out it was a job. And when I found out it was a job to a large extent, it began to lose its hold on me, and my artistic side began to assert itself. And slowly the two sort of overlapped, and one faded and one took primacy, and I started writing. And I worked for 15 years for ad agencies around Richmond, corporations. I wrote everything. I wrote everything from radio commercials, TV commercials, bus cards. I did a campaign for GRTC. And that's a great schoolhouse because I had to count my words when it was billboards, 13 words at a max. Had to time them if it was radio or TV. You had to count them if it was a press release. So I learned brevity. And I learned get to the point.
The first successful book was?
Well, of course, we have to define success. The first book that was published was Souls to Keep. But the first book I wrote was War of the Rats.
I noticed on your website that you have a sailboat. So that's one measure of success.
Oh, War of the Rats, to be very honest, was a worldwide bestseller. It has sold 1 million copies in 16 languages. You know, the movie Enemy at the Gates was taken from it. So, yeah, War of the Rats was really the first time where I really looked at it and said, I could make a living doing this and not have to do other things. And that, to me, is where the bar needs to be set for a professional artist. Whether you dance or paint or sculpt or write, is can you make your living through your art?
And you've been doing that now for how long?
About 10 years.
Well, let's hear a little bit of your art.
Ah, okay. Well, at your request, I have brought 4 of my 9 novels. They were just the 4 that jumped into my hands off my shelf. And I'm going to read some of my favorite passages from these books. They're chosen because they're passages I remember writing, that when I wrote them, I remember being particularly pleased with them. And this first one is, it is, in fact, the opening to my novel Scorched Earth, which was 2001. And these are the first 2 scenes in the book. I won't introduce it because these are the first scenes. The place where they lie making the child is beautiful. They lie on a bed of ferns, which, like a cushion of feathers, tickles them. Only a few strides off the old dirt road, they are beneath a tall red oak, thick as a chimney, bearded with gray bark. The tree is a gentle old presence. The leaves of the oak bear the first blush of whistling autumn. If they were to stand on that spot, they could see the fields. South lie 40 acres of beans, leafy and ripe, for the harvest machinery resting now after church on this Sunday afternoon. High pines and turning sugar maples make this field a leafy, green loch where every breeze riffles. North of the road, beyond barbed wire and honeysuckle, is a cleared pasture for the cows which are out of sight behind hills that rise and roll down, suggesting by their smooth undulation the couple lying under the oak. He is a black man, blacker than everything, blacker than the soil of the road, everything but the crows. His name is Elijah, named by his mother for the loudest of the Hebrew prophets, though he has not grown into a loud man. He is as silent as his skin, as the dark of a well. Beneath him, wrapping him like roots seeking water, is his wife, Claire. Her green eyes are closed behind white, blue-veined lids. Waist-length blonde hair spreads over the ferns, and under her back she kisses him, and their tongues twine. A band of starlings crisscrosses the field. The ebon birds strike something invisible in the center of the field and disperse to clot again and circle some more, somewhat aimlessly. Claire and Elijah, tangled together, white and black, are absolutes, the presence and absence of all colors at once, sharing a smooth, perfect motion. And this is scene two. Claire and Elijah Waddell live in a shotgun shack 2 miles down post-delivery route 310. By the way, just as a note, whenever I use numbers in books, I always use 310 because it's my birthday, March 10th. So if I make up a road, I always call it Route 310. It's a stupid thing I do. Their small house stands 5 miles east of the town of Good Hope, the county seat for Pamunkey County. Local wags call these single-story, slant-roofed homes shotgun shacks because if you stood in the front doorway and fired a shotgun blast, you'd kill everyone through the whole house. Elijah and Claire bought the place last year, just after they married. For 5 months, they sanded the heart pine floors, put in new kitchen cabinets, and painted the clapboards. Claire wanted the exterior painted pink and got Dusky Rose, their compromise. The house came with 10 acres, all of it except Claire and Elijah's vegetable garden, is leased to a corn farmer who cultivates 400 acres on both sides of the road down to the river. The house and yard and the dusty lane are walled in by rising corn from May through October until the crop is harvested. Elijah and Claire enjoy the isolation. Coming home once from their jobs at the paper mill, Claire took Elijah's hand and stood beside their mailbox, the silk's tassels higher than their heads. She said, "It's like being Hansel and Gretel coming up on the gingerbread house, isn't it?" Elijah is 10 years older than Claire. She is 22, but they share the same wiry build and long frame. His is a face of circles, pliant with wide nostrils, long earlobes, and arching brows over dark pupils. Claire's features are round, too, but resemble the roundness of an infant. When it can be, theirs is a sweaty, dirty love. They groom their big summer garden and work on the house. They bring each other iced tea. They make love in the rope hammock at nightfall in full sight of the road, daring the path to bring them an intruder. In winter, they chop and carry wood. Elijah has knocked down a wall to take the space from a closet and add it to a baby's room. Claire carries the detritus outside in a wheelbarrow, shoveling chips and scraps into the pickup to be hauled to the dump. They pull off their clothes to laugh at the dirty regions, hands, arms, necks, and faces, her whiteness showing the grit most, his grime blending into his skin. They make love that way, too, with the dirt of home chores or the stink of the paper mill in their hair and clothes. Work seems to make them want each other, like thirst. Claire and Elijah have a dog, a gray cocker named Herschel. It is Herschel who, in this first year of their marriage, shows Claire that her husband contains in him places she has not yet entered. On a summer Sunday, Herschel lies heaving on the back stoop of the house. His breath grates in his throat. His tongue lolls from his mouth onto the boards. The dog's neck is swollen terribly, as though bees have built a hive inside it. Elijah finds him on the stoop and shouts for Claire to bring the truck around. Herschel has been bitten by a snake. Elijah lays Herschel on the seat, the dog's head in Claire's lap, his tongue on her bare thigh. He drives fast to the vet, who confirms Elijah's diagnosis and gives the dog antivenin. The vet tells them to leave Herschel overnight. Returning to the house, Elijah walks away from the pickup to the backyard shed. Claire remains in the yard. Elijah emerges with his rubber fishing waders over his arm. "There's another pair," he says. "Come if you want." Claire watches him enter the house. In a minute, he exits, carrying his old side-by-side shotgun and a box of 12-gauge shells. She runs to the shed for the other rubber coveralls. Elijah slowly drives the quarter mile to the end of the dirt road, where he turns left up the farmer's tractor path. He stops the truck at the foot of the trees and looks at Claire. His face is blank as slate, as though all purpose has been drained from it to better fuel his will. He climbs out, and Claire follows. The cornfield stops here, the rim of it barbered neat. The air tastes musky along the riverbank in the shade. These trees were left in place 2 centuries ago, when the land was first put under the plow to hold the bank together. The roots of the trees closest to the river stick out of the bank, exposed by times of high water. Elijah pulls on the waders, then breaks the shotgun, slips in shells, leaves the barrel open over his arm, and clambers down the bank, holding on to the roots. Where the roots meet the water, spreading like arteries, is where the copperheads make their nests. Elijah moves into the water as though he himself were reptilian, without ripple or sound. Claire puts on the second pair of rubber bibs. They go on easily because they are too big. She eases herself into the water, but still makes a small splash, stepping in. 30 yards ahead, Elijah does not turn. He snaps closed the shotgun and raises it. He lets go with one barrel, then another. The branches overhead shake with the report, and where he has aimed, smoke whirls on the water. Something thrashes. Elijah unsnaps and reloads. He fires again into a cascade of roots, leaving another specter of smoke as a marker. He wades the river the length of the field, almost a half mile, firing the shotgun into the water, against the banks, under roots. Green plastic shells and shredded bits of snakes and bark float past Claire on the slow current. She is surprised the water is not redder with blood. After most of an hour, when an empty cardboard shell box drifts past her, Elijah stops walking, the shotgun under his armpit. He does not turn to Claire, but stands watching the current slide past his thighs. Claire clambers out of the river and walks back to the truck. She removes the overalls and sits in the cab. Elijah does not appear. She considers honking the horn, but does not. She sits alone for another hour, eyeing the yellow palisade of corn. "I had no idea," she thinks. "No idea how much my husband can love."
David, have you ever killed a copperhead?
Yes.
Is that how you knew how to write that?
No. I did that. That's a scorched earth, interestingly, which is perhaps why I read it first and perhaps why it's one of my books I'm most fond of. Has a lot of my own autobiography in it. None of my other books, really. I'm not on the page very much. Every artist is unavoidable, that every character you create is some image out of your own head. It's unavoidable, but rarely do I personally mine my own life. Herschel was the cockapoo of an ex-girlfriend whose grandfather, Buck, lived in Danville. And Buck got bit by a copperhead. And Buck put on the overalls, and I followed him. I was Claire, and he shot every damn copperhead he could find for biting his dog. He was just the most gentle man, lovely man. And when after that episode, I just looked at him with a new set of eyes. I thought, I just did not know this man. You know, he had this place in him where you could never have guessed that he would have had this surge of anger that he expressed so quietly. Well, insofar as a shotgun is quiet, but he didn't talk about it before. He didn't talk about it after. He just said, "You can come." And I was always, and this book has a lot of things out of my own life that have moved me, where I had epiphanies about people or myself.
You say that you are more in Scorched Earth than in your other work. We're interested in hearing some more of your other work, and I'm interested in hearing how you write things that aren't of your own life.
Well, that's a great segue into this next piece I'd like to read is from the novel I will be bringing out, Simon & Schuster, on November 10th of this year, which is 2009, called Broken Jewel. This scene is, and I tell you in advance before I read it, the scene is a bit grim. The novel is set in the Philippines in 1945. The Japanese Army, one of the war crimes that they committed that has gone to a large extent unrecorded and unrepented for to a large extent, is that the Japanese kidnapped, numbers dictate, between 250,000 and 400,000 virginal women in the South Pacific, or in the Pacific Rim, the Philippines, Korea, China, the nations they'd conquered. Between the ages of 14 and 19, they kidnapped them or they fooled them, and they took them and they raped them. And they made them what was called comfort women. When their job was to be sexual slaves, it's important to note they were not geishas, they were not prostitutes. They were literally slaves, kept in the physical conditions of slavery. They weren't allowed out. They were literally kept in not physical bondage, but locked in. And they were kept as sex slaves for the Japanese army, ostensibly for three purposes: to reduce the incidences of rape amongst the soldiers in the community, let them get their rocks off in a, you know, in a controlled setting, to reduce the amount of the spread of venereal disease, which didn't happen because they wouldn't wear condoms, and, you know, they were young soldiers, and three, to prevent the spread of military secrets. You know, because if you're sleeping with a woman in the village and she's a Filipino and you're the enemy, you're going to say things. And so so they established, the Japanese Army established a thing called the comfort stations and comfort women. And so I've written a novel where the heroine is a young Filipina. Her name is Carmen. And I wanted to read this scene. This is one of the most powerful scenes for me personally that I've ever written. And
so listeners, be forewarned.
Don't go anywhere, but I think you might prepare to cringe. I will say that this is, I think this is as good as I can write. This is from Broken Jewel, Chapter 4. She sat up to her elbows to watch the young soldier. He laid his ticket on the table beside the door. The thin chit lay on a pile of 10, 15. She did not know. Never did she count. Mama simply swept the vouchers away at the end of the day. The Japanese greeted her with a quick nod. Sungu. By the way, the Japanese call her Songu, which her name is Carmen, which of course is Spanish for song or singer. So Songu would be the sort of anglicization of that. So they call her Songu. He set both hands to work undoing his pantaloons, then stopped to remove his cap. He held it by the brim, searching for a place to hang it or set it down. He put it back on his head, sheepish and uncertain. She watched him between her brown knees. Carmen did not recognize him. He was not one of the camp guards. Early this morning, a long convoy had rattled past the camp. This boy was likely on his way to Manila. Someone in his unit brought him, perhaps on a dare, to the Shuho of Los Baños. The boy's khakis dropped in folds around his boots and leggings. He wore a loincloth, which he pushed down his thighs. At the edge of her tatami, he stood naked only at the hips. He had small tufts of hair above his penis. He looked down at himself, raw in this room smelling of Mama's bleach mop. Behind Carmen's head, through the open window, a bird cawed. This drew the boy's attention. He looked up, biting his bottom lip. He seemed to want to be out there instead, in the air, flying off. Carmen saw that this was his first time with a woman. She pointed at his penis, not meeting his eyes. Saku. Surprised, did he expect a corpse with no voice? The soldier made a perfunctory bow. With both hands, he hauled up the accordion of his pantaloons to rummage in a pocket. He found the paper envelope. Without lowering his pants, he tore the pocket open, then had to push down his breeches again to let his penis stand between the tails of his tunic. He held the rubber condom ring with fingertips. He halted with no notion of how to put it on. Carmen wanted to send him away, push him out the window to give him his chance to fly. She remained motionless except to gaze down at her own bare hips, the black tuft that was hers, and considered that if she had a penis there, she would not be on this mattress. That was the difference, but it seemed not enough to explain things. The soldier held up the ring to her, asking for help. Carmen stared back deadpan. He drew his lips over his protruding teeth, determined to figure this out. The Japanese boy did the wrong thing. He poked a finger into the rubber ring, pushing the condom out to its full, flaccid length. He lowered the sack to his penis and tried to tug it on like a sock instead of rolling it back. The condom slid on partially, leaving half its length dangling. His breathing became irregular with his frustration. The boy's glance rose from his own chaos to her vagina. With a grunt, he determined to get rid of the condom, pinching it at the tip to yank it off. The thing snapped when it jerked free. Before the boy could bend his knees to the tatami or Carmen could raise a hand to stop him, the soldier ejaculated. His stream landed in milky beads across Carmen's stomach and inner thighs onto her open robe. She looked down at the trail and thought nothing of the boy's warm semen on her skin. She knew what would come next, the necessary trade for being done with him quickly. Averting her eyes, she sat up straight to make her face easy for him to reach. The boy's hand clapped against her temple, sweeping her off balance. She tumbled to her side, not catching herself, but acting out the receipt of a great blow. She lifted a hand to her cheek and whimpered to assuage his loss of pride. The boy stood over her, dripping. The Japanese raised a finger to his bulging lips, making the signal for silence. Say nothing. Carmen nodded, aping fear. He flung the condom to the floor and pulled up his loincloth and pantaloons. Carmen did not take her hand from her cheek to show the sting was mighty. The soldier buttoned and buckled himself into place, glaring at her to drive home their compact that he would not strike her again if she told no one. Carmen lowered her eyes, the final act of her role. The soldier drew himself up, almost to attention, to leave her room, and the shoehole looking satisfied and commanding. Carmen supposed he was a year younger than she, perhaps two. He gazed down his nose and nodded approval, beginning the deception that would last the rest of his life. He spun on his heels and swept beyond the curtain. Carmen lowered her hand, bothering only to hope that his life would be short.
Well, Broken Jewel, to be published this November. There's so many things that I would like to ask you and talk to you about, but we do have limited time. And this is so good. Could you read one more thing for us?
Sure. Oh, this one's funny. We'll do a funny one. How's that?
Great.
That one's kind of... This is a funny one. This is from the Assassin's Gallery. It came out about four years ago. Michael Lamach is the hero of this. Michael Lamach is a professor, and this is a World War II book, and he is a professor of political science, and his specialty is assassinations. And what Michael Lamach wants to know is, when you assassinate a world leader, what does history do? Does history just parade on in a straight line, or does history, hike up her skirt and take a left or a right? And that way, he can study whether or not, as a political scientist, he can study whether or not individuals make history, or great events and peoples make history. And Michael Lamach, because he studies assassinations, he's also made himself an expert in weapons. So he's an older man. He's about his mid-50s here. He's kind of portly. And he's a weapons trainer for the OSS in Scotland. And this scene here is where he meets some new recruits. January 2nd, Tomdoon Highlands, Scotland. Lamach pointed into the dusk. There! The driver slammed on brakes, bodies and curses jumbled in the truck bed. You missed the turn, Lamach chided. The driver, a soldier half Lamach's age and a fraction his size, said, sorry, and shifted to reverse. Lamach shouted behind him to the men riding under the tarp. You all right back there? It's dark. You missed the turn. You think so? Answered a droll Scottish voice. Christ, mate, returned a Cockney. The truck backed to the sign, almost lost in the thick shadows of wild forest growth. The last of the Highland afternoon retained only frosty strands of light snared by the hills and branches of the Lochaber foothills. The air bore a wet chill that only a snug pub and lukewarm ale could disperse. Down a pebbled track 100 yards off the narrow road stood the Crow and Candle. An inviting yellow glow stemmed from ancient windows, wood smoke screwed from a chimney. Lamach lowered the tailgate. 8 of his trainees jumped out. Hey, he shouted, don't forget Hunk. The last soldier, a kilted Scot, smacked the palm to his head and jumped back into the bed to retrieve the sandbag dummy. All of them filed into the tavern, ducking to enter except the tiny driver, an Irish kid. They swarmed to a poorly lit corner, borrowing tables and chairs to make themselves a camp. Hunk, carried in on the Scot's shoulder, was plopped upright in his own seat. The dummy had been dressed in the fatigues of a Royal Marine, swiped from the trunk of a teetotaler who wouldn't come out tonight. Lamach ordered Hunk a stout. With cigarettes lit and beers delivered, Lamach held court. Around him sat 3 Englishmen, 2 Irishmen, 2 Canadians, 1 Frenchman, 1 Scotsman, and 1 dummy. Lamach raised his mug. These boys were Jedburghs, the name for the multinational clandestine teams recruited and trained by the British Special Operations Executive, the SOE, to operate behind enemy lines. To you, my lads, and to all the Jedburghs who've come before you. The young men lifted their glasses and clinked all around. The Scot hoisted Hunk's arm and stout for him. All right, Lamach said, wiping foam from his beard. What do we have here? I know most of you specialize in weapons. What else do we have? Wireless and ciphers, said one of the Brits. Ooh, ciphers. Riddles, the crew laughed. Tell us a cipher, Lamach ordered. 031054. You are now the Sphinx, anointed Lamach. Next. Languages, answered the Frenchman. Lamach asked, which? Japanese. Really? And of course, Burmese. Of course. After all, we are going to Burma, n'est-ce pas? And he speaks French, shouted the Scot. Bloody talented. Say something in Burmese, Lamach egged the Frenchman. Ein ta be malay. What was that? I said, where is the toilet? Lou, Lamach christened him, and the Frenchman's nickname was permanent. The Frenchman attempted to contest it, but the rest of the boys cheered and slapped him on the shoulders, crooning, Lou. Lamach took a sip. He set the beer down hard like a gavel, then tilted his chair back from the table to take more room for his belly and chest. You, with a jab of his hand, he indicated the Scotsman. Specialty. Sabotage. Careful, Hunk, the Irish lad said, leaning across the table to the sandbug dummy. He'll piss in your beer. Hesperus, said Lemmick. Crikey, man, what the hell kind of name is that? Hesperus? That may be something else, Professor. The Wreck of Hesperus, Longfellow, our greatest American poet. Lemmick waited for the connection to sink in and got nothing. The Wreck, one of the Canadians pinched in. Get it? Wreck? You're a saboteur. Oh, the Scotsman understood. Yeah, okay, I like that. Hesperus, a bleeding poet, too. In a skirt, the Frenchman muttered. Lamech spread his arms across the back of the chairs on each side. He was easily the largest man at the table. These SOE Jegboro boys were going to be parachuted behind Japanese lines in three-man paramilitary teams as guerrillas, WT operators, which would be wireless. Underground liaisons for resistance and wreckers. They needed to be fox-quick, steel-nerved, and clever, not brutes. Then the rest of you are weapons, yes? Good. Let's see what you wee lads know before we start you out tomorrow. Sphinx, Lou, Hesperus, you pay attention. When we're finished training, you'll need to know as much as everyone else. All right, favorite weapons. Who's first? He indicated the Canadian who knew about Longfellow. Yukon? The young man grinned, accepting the label. A silenced M3 submachine gun, .45 caliber. The weight of the silencer adds balance to help keep the muzzle down. Inaudible at 200 yards, wonderful stopping power, lightweight, sturdy, excellent for indoor use. Nods accompanied this choice. Lamech sipped his beer and said nothing, gazing at the Canadian. Uh-oh, muttered the Sphinx. Lamech shook his head, mocking sadness. Two things I don't like about the M3 SMG. One, the silencer needs to be cleaned of carbon every 300 rounds, or it'll actually sound louder than if you didn't have the damn thing on. In the jungle, you may go through 10 magazines in 10 minutes or 10 weeks, but either way, you better keep track. And two, that's an American OSS gun not available to Sexton 136. Next. You? Lamech stabbed a finger at the small Irishman. Easy, the soldier said, an eager and devilish twist in his eyes. But it's another Yank gun, Professor, so don't tear me an arsehole over it. The Thompson SMG with a 230 grain 45 caliber round, 100-shot drum magazine, 879 rounds a minute. It could be stripped and reassembled in 60 seconds with no tools. Loud, powerful, reliable, balanced, spits flame, and the best-looking goddamn gun ever made. True, true, and true, Lamech agreed mildly. It also weighs 20 pounds with that magazine. You want to lug that son of a bitch through the jungle with Japo on your trail? Go ahead. I think it would be better just to shoot yourself with it and be done. The Irish lad was not defeated by the laughter and clinking glasses. Lamech smiled. Your name will be Capone. Next, anyone really want to use a British-made gun? Since you're being equipped by Britain, I recommend it. A handsome English boy raised his beer. Stem gun. Lightweight, inexpensive, 9mm. Can be used with a silencer. The Brit glanced across the table at Yukon, who also favored a silenced machine gun. But the Sten silencer works with baffles, not screens, so it requires less cleaning and upkeep. Makes more of a hiss than the regular clap of a firearm. Durable, withstands mud, sand, and water better than any other submachine gun. The Brit paused. Lamech waited him out to see if the boy knew. He did. And yes, Professor, the silencer does reduce the penetrating power of the 9mm round. And? The Brit sighed. And it has an alarming tendency to loose off an entire magazine if dropped. The solution, fellows? Lamech challenged. Everyone chimed in. Don't drop it! And you, my lad, Lamech raised his ale to the Englishman, I dub thumbs.
The Assassin's Gallery by David L. Robbins. David, really, really wonderful to have you here today.
A thrill. A thrill. Thank you. I'll come anytime.
We'll have you back. We've been talking with David L. Robbins. I'm Patty Campbell for the Virginia Voice.
You've been listening to The Writer's Voice. Listen online or download to your computer or MP3 player at www.virginiavoice.org. Virginia Voice. Connect by listening.